Now we're rolling.
Now we're rolling, sure?
Yeah. I can monitor, I hear myself, and there's a gap, because it's actually playing back what's being recorded, which is different from what I hear in my ear. There's a lag.
Interesting. Looks like a very professional studio, sound studio.
Well, it's fun to make the tapes are good. The quality of our voicing is very audible, so anybody who ever listens to these, and I assume someday Simone or whatever, someone, or children that aren't yet born,
right,
would be very interested by this, potentially.
Yeah.
So,
when they go to school in the third and fourth grade?
Yeah, and they're doing whatever.
This is my great-uncle Dave and my great-grandmother.
If things last that long and there's some kind of, revitalization of our culture's ability to adapt to things, which we all hope will happen handily. So,
well, we have to go on that basis. That's all there is to it.
That's right.
Otherwise, there's no point.
There's no point. I just have some pieces from what you had said before that I wanted to touch upon. And first, this business of what we've just heard and what I'm going to put on the tape later on the back of the other side A, we're on side B now, of this difference between, I guess one could say, a Western focus of having things be very individual, very centered around the individual person and what they do, or as to define who they are, as distinct from, as we heard in this tape, of a Navajo way of, and perhaps other indigenous peoples having something similar, where one is defined by one's family and one's relations, familial relations, and that experience of being known.
And where you're from, because this guy was so-and-so from Greasy Water.
Right. But all the connections of place and of people that binds one to that, to all that's happening there. And I was struck so much by this last time in March, hearing you describe things and not understanding some as you were talking, and even, well, mostly as you're talking. Since then, I've understood more of thinking about what you had said at one point of the Chinese chimes, letters your parents would write home, and you've never been able to read those because it's just too much. And when I first heard you say that, I was thinking, I'd want to read those if I were you, but of course I'm not you, and I don't know at all what you lived of what you were describing, which the more I've thought about it and gone back and listened to these tapes from then to now, better appreciating something of what it must have been like to have been so, the word you use near the end is displaced, and third culture syndrome of not belonging any place, and not being of any place. But it was interesting because you described the example when your mom's mother died and she had to go back to find someone to take care of her father, your grandfather, and she didn't want to go alone, and she asked you to come with her, and you didn't want to go because at that point you were starting to feel in your ninth year or so some real connectedness with where you had been, at least at that point.
It was with the people, though.
With the people that were where you'd
the
been.
The kids. It was the socialization project. Experience away from my family were there, but it was that I was in the teenage years, and I had found my own group, and they were in China, they were not in the States. So probably at that point I was like any other teenager universally that doesn't want to be moved out of finally making friends that were there.
So there you actually weren't displaced. Had you been able to stay, you were feeling more and more a sense of, perhaps the first time in some ways, by being in a place long enough and being of the age you were where, well, where you had these connections that were growing up and had some kind of time behind them that you could really start to groove on and grow into. It was something that wasn't tenuous or fleeting or uncapturable. It was very much manifesting for you. And so there was experience of not being displaced. But then once more you were displaced when you had to follow your mom.
Yeah.
And take a year. At one point you were mentioning with a birthday party, there was different people on the back of the photograph. You were laughing very spiritedly of seeing and recognizing table boy's face peering through the glass door.
Oh, yeah. Remember that one.
Kitchen swinging door to come in when needed or called for, and or whenever the situation would call for it. And at that point, you were trying to remember names, and there was something with that. Maybe it was earlier than that, because you were talking about a picture that was before you were born, but a woman there, you were trying to remember her name, and you finally remembered Isabel Phelps. You said, she loved me a lot.
Mm-hmm.
Tell me more about Isabel Phelps. Where did she come from? Who was she? What was her connection?
She was one of those single missionaries, single lady missionaries. She was a minister. There were a lot of them that went to China. They're very intelligent. They had a lot of intellect. Their primary goal, and this would be in the early 1900s, was to probably live a life of service and not primarily to establish a family. So the mission boards at that time were taking both single men and single women or married couples. And this was a way that single women could have a career. So Isabel Phelps was a minister. I'm pretty sure she was a minister. And I don't know, maybe women at that time, way back then, I don't know where she went to school, but she got a ministerial degree of some sort. And she lived in the ladies' house. Every compound had a ladies' house for single women. And she lived with Aunt Mary Andrews, who probably had been a teacher. And Aunt Mary Andrews was very old. She probably was in her 90s. And she was quite a small, shriveled little lady with white hair. And she wanted to die and be buried in China. I don't know what happened to Aunt Mary Andrews, but she was there with Isabel Phelps. And then there were some other women that came and went. I think Grace Breck was there for a while. I think Grace Breck, I don't know what her, what her education was, but all these people were trained, and they both taught in schools. And Isabel Phelps, I think, went out in the country and did Bible study work with women. Anyway, somehow Isabel Phelps just loved me as a little girl. And she and I, at a certain time, and I was talking to Gladys, I think she said, it wasn't Gladys, it was probably Losmere, that there was a certain era. Maybe Losmere lost her brother, her younger brother, and her mother never got out of it, over it, because there was scarlet fever going around. And I developed scarlet fever, and my mother took care of me. Scarlet fever there was no treatment, and many people just died of it because it's a it's a bacterial infection. I'm not sure it's bacterial or viral, but there was no treatment, and you ran a very, very high fever, went out of your head quite often, and it was hot. You became dehydrated.
Yeah.
So Isabel Phelps and I had this scarlet fever at the same time. And she lived in the lady's house, and I was in our house in Bouding Phu. And my mother took care of me upstairs in the second floor. And she was the only one besides the doctor that would come Dr. Lewis that would come across the Chinese city of Badingfu to our compound. He was the doctor in the one foreign hospital, but it was a different mission board. And he would come periodically, and I don't know what he did, just...
to try and make you more comfortable.
Make me more comfortable. And my poor mother just had to take care of me. And she didn't get it.
And she had to hope that she didn't get it.
Yeah.
Because one could...
Oh, yeah. But people did die.
But you were her daughter, so she needed to try and comfort
you. That's right. And I was probably 4 or 5. And interesting, just this last visit to Sedona, to hear Losimir talk about her baby brother who died, and it was scarlet fever, and it's about the same time. So it must have been rampant at that time. Probably most all the Chinese would get killed off. See, this was the part of the strange business, that the Chinese outside of the compound were sick and would die, and that's just what happened to them. And this was a very peculiar thing, that we foreigners living within the camp, I mean, it was never articulated this way, but I must have absorbed it, that we somehow were special, not just different, but special. We white folks, right. White men's burden, and we lived.
Yeah.
So Isabel Phelps would be out of her head part-time, and she told me afterwards that she, in her time that she was out of her body into hallucinating, that she would come over and see me and make sure I was all right. And so that's Isabel Phelps. I don't know whatever happened to her. She was a very strong woman, very opinionated. She wasn't very well liked, but she did adore me because I can see looking at Dan Chambers' little daughter, little golden head girl living in the compound. So.
And perhaps, possibly, whatever you reminded her of things for herself, maybe she had...
Maybe she was a little golden-haired girl at one time.
Without many friends, and just recognized something of you.
Or something of her own childhood. Yeah. Usually there's a personal identification with anything like that.
Mm-hmm.
And she may have been a little prized possession in her family. And so many of these women had very... You know, they had strong roots, and most of them strong fathers that approved of them to give them a start.
Which your dad did.
Yeah.
You felt not having the connection with your mother that you so yearned to have and wished you could somehow, and realized very, very early, and I want to talk about that, what you had said, but clearly from what you were saying last time, your experience with Grandpa, your father, Harold, was very rich and supportive, and you knew he really liked you.
He responded. I could get a reaction. He would mirror my needs, and my mother didn't know how to do that.
Mm-hmm. With your sense of the... You said... with this, there was after the passport photo, back to Baodingfu. After we talked about the passport photo and coming back, and then the picture, we were looking at the picture of the sleeping porch, and you said, "My mother was hard. I mean, she was so depressed, and a difficult life for her. And I remember when I would go to bed on that sleeping porch, I would say my prayers and I would say, I made up a poem about, I love the sleeping porch. My bed is my second mother. It was comfortable. I could be cozy. And I knew that my mother couldn't be that way for me. And I asked, even when you were 3 or 4? And you responded, yes, or 5 probably. Because I do remember sitting someplace on my bed or her bed or the stairs and realizing that there was nothing I could do to make her happy. It was really sad. I think it was at that point that I decided I had to take care of myself. And there's so much in that I to be that young and to recognize how very sad one could see one's mother being, that one's mother could never be there for one in some fundamental way, and realizing that one had to provide that same elemental, primal comfort from within. There's a certain quality, to me it feels like, to recognize that would bespeak on some level a high degree of awareness.
Well, you see, this is all looking back. I think it was all an unconscious. I remember, but I think what I remember was putting consciousness on something that I understood at that time, non-verbally, at a very deep level. So it wasn't, I'm sure that it was not something I would have been able to put into words.
Yeah. And yet, on some level you knew you couldn't make her happy. So, and I suppose on any level a child would feel that they could take great delight in delighting their parents.
Well, it's the way of children. It's the way of growing up, that the ideal parenting mirrors the child, mirrors the child's nonverbal behavior, so that the child feels connected to the world by being connected to that parent. Mm-hmm. And I got it from other people. I got it from my Emma, and I got it from my father. And there was a sense in my family of there was a stability about that family, although Dad was gone a lot of the time out in the country. But I knew he was coming back. My mother never expressed any fear around that, that he might not come back, or she was a solid person. I mean, there had been a lot of women that would have been very nervous and anxious about all of that, but she wasn't. She just was emotionally just depressed.
Which goes back to her beginnings. That's something that probably always she had.
Yeah.
Just in her nature.
Well,
at least in her
probably in her upbringing. And I think probably it's amazing, you know, as I subsequently was thinking about her on Mother's Day this year, realizing what an amazing, because her parents were very hard-boiled, or, you know, her father was almost not there at all emotionally. Her mother was very practical and probably trying to keep the family together. And I think I told you that Betty Jean had told me about Grandfather Stambaugh, that he had been into the occult. And I'm sure that my grandmother thought that was just beyond the pale, that he must be crazy, or he just was not with it. Or I don't know whether he was totally impractical. He might have been totally impractical, so she really had to hold everything together. Mm-hmm. That might have been it. And at some point, Harold told me, maybe it's on the tape already, that she had threatened to divorce him, and she did separate from him.
Which
was amazing for that. I mean, that era, a wife didn't do that.
Yeah.
But she must have been a very unusual woman. You know, with a lot of, I don't know what her, I think maybe in Grandma Robinson's Stambaugh material you may find that Grandmother Stambaugh's mother died. I'm not sure if I remember
that. When
she
was younger?
Yeah, when she was a little girl.
So she
didn't get mothering. I'm not sure. I may have remembered that about somebody else, but there was a lot of material in those Stambaugh papers.
Well, from what you said, I'm very interested to find out more about that, because I realize I know nothing about my mother's line. I know that she was in Northwest,
mm-hmm.
and that Chief Joseph came to her parents' store. That's the only story I know about that whole line of.
Mm-hmm. That's about all I know, except what's in these papers.
So I'll have to really get digging.
That's very interesting.
Well, and
this listening to the Tony Hillerman stories and thinking so much about a culture that defines itself matrilineally. So the line is passed down through the mother's family. So that goes back in that direction. It's not Grandpa's Robinson's family or Grandpa Ratcliffe or Grandma Ratcliffe. It's Grandma Robinson's line.
Mm-hmm.
And between that and I think
But it's interesting, in John's family, you know more about his mother than you do about his father. Or I do, because I spent a little time there in Beloit. With Jenny was Grandma Ratcliffe's mother, Jenny Thompson. And she was this little bitty bird-like woman, a real matriarchal, fierce little woman. That with all these children, I forget how many children she had, 7 or 8. And a great big husband who was about 3 times as tall as she was, lived in this huge house with a ballroom on the 3rd floor in Beloit.
I don't know.
I'm sure John has talked to you about that.
Not much, no. I've never heard about a ballroom on the 3rd floor.
Yeah.
I heard about someone who would, obviously, that he would have picked up from of waiting when they were going to go someplace. She was ready long before they'd go and just snapping at everybody.
Probably Jenny.
And that she was all ready to go, but why wasn't anybody else ready? And she was just, there was nothing to wait for. She was ready to walk out the door. She had her cane or whatever, but she...
She insisted that Grandma Ratcliffe, she wanted her to, I think she was the oldest daughter, perhaps.
Her daughter.
Yeah. To Nanette, to be a good pianist. So she bought her this grand piano, which, no, John doesn't have.
That's not that one.
I don't know what happened to that piano. Anyway, she was given that piano in Beloit, and when Nanette practiced all she could possibly stand, Jenny would stand and whip her legs. And this is what John's mother told us, and I guess make them bleed. I mean, she was a cruel bastard lady. And everybody was kind of laughed at her, but they were afraid of her. And after, when Nan Thompson married, she married Frank, and he was beneath them. He was a lower class man from, I forget what town, Olney.
Olney.
And they were from Wisconsin, and he was from Olney, Illinois. Don't know how she met him, but anyway. So they moved to Tulsa. Maybe they moved to Olney first.
I think they were in Olney for a while.
And then, yeah, because I think John was born there.
Yeah.
And then the possession that Grandma Ratcliffe took with her was her piano. Huh. But she would never let anybody play that piano.
Yeah.
And it was just an ornament.
Piece of furniture.
Yeah, and she hated music so much she wouldn't even let Frank play his flute.
But Dad had all this access with radio, at least, of listening to symphony on the radio.
Oh, yeah, but he could listen to radio, but he wasn't, because she had been so abused around the playing any instrument that she couldn't stand it, or this is how it came out in her.
Right.
She wouldn't allow it, rather than if you want to, go ahead, but,
sure.
You know, she wouldn't allow it. And when Jenny, when I visited in Beloit, Jenny sat at the head of the table still. It had big dining room, big round oval table. And everybody would be always making her eat because she just picked at her food. So she finally bought herself a tiny little Chinese screen, folding screen, that she'd put out in front of her plate. And so that nobody could see if she ate or not. So they stopped bothering her. That's what I remember about her.
Wow.
As a person.
But you don't remember that much about your own mother's family background.
Well, I just remember that about John's, because I've heard him speak about it, and because I spent some time in his
when
family.
When you were older, when you were
yeah,
an adult.
Yeah, in the home that he grew up in.
Mm-hmm.
So.
But they'd already moved to Long Beach.
Oh, in the home that his mother grew up in, yeah.
Mm-hmm.
So I've had some contact with her. I mean, she was a character. And I think probably Grandmother Stambo was too, but I didn't know her that way. I mean, she didn't show her character, her cartoon quality in the same way that Jenny did.
But you also didn't get to know her as long because she died when you were eight. Because then your mom had to come back and find someone to take care of your grandpa.
No, I was 14 that time. I was just finished my freshman high school year.
So that picture we were looking at today.
That was an 8-year-old. That was the furlough picture, 32.
Okay. I'm trying to get this microphone better. That was a furlough picture. So you came back when you were 13 or 14? When you're
with my mother, yeah. It was not a regular furlough.
When your grandma died.
Right.
She died of
old age. There's in that bunch of things, there's a small, I think it's got lines on it, a piece of paper about this big, and it's from Grandmother Stamba to Mary, my mother, saying that she was writing from the hospital and she thought she was dying and she would already be dead by the time my mother got this letter.
And she was?
I'm sure she was, yeah. It was a very touching letter because it was, she wanted her daughter to know she was dying.
That's in your papers?
Yeah.
Her name was?
Ada, as my middle name. Ada Stamba. Ada Woolley Stamba.
Is she, her picture isn't in Grandpa's story, I don't think. I think there's just the, there's the picture of Grandma, of Mary, with that guitar. Or at least I know that's a very familiar picture. Maybe I've seen it someplace else. We were just looking at that today with her brother with the violin.
Yeah.
What's her brother's name?
Guy.
Guy. That's Uncle Guy.
Yeah.
She just had one brother.
Right.
One sibling.
Well, and also in this material, there was another sibling who died. And I have a colleague who did research on manic depressive illness. And his thesis was that manic depressive illness occurred in families where a generation before someone had died and no one ever talked about it, which was very interesting to me to read. I just read that last Mother's Day. That Grandmother Stamba lost a sibling. I never knew about it. I doubt if it was ever spoken about. And Harold was manic depressive.
And you had a lot of depression, at least when I was born. If not in your formative adult years or whatever.
Yeah, I've had a lot of depression, but it hasn't been clinical depression.
What does that mean?
Unable to function, unable to get out of bed. Mm-hmm. I've had lots of energy.
Mm-hmm.
And it's a kind of a depression. It's called anxiety depression.
You're closed down, but you're operational.
And there's anxiety that goes with it. But you get out of bed. I mean, clinically depressed people can't get out of bed. They simply can't function. And if you're living with them, you can't believe it. Get up! Come on now! What's the matter with you? Everything's going fine. I don't think my mother ever had that either. She may have.
But if she was, if a sibling of hers was born and then died soon after or whenever.
I don't know. You'll read about it.
And this was, this must have been younger than her.
I think it's in that envelope
of
Stambo family papers.
Uh-huh.
Information.
So I'll find out what the hierarchy was.
Yeah.
Was Guy older than her?
Guy was younger.
So she's the firstborn.
Well, I'm not sure she's the firstborn. She might have been the secondborn.
Okay.
She was either the first or the second. I don't remember when the sibling died.
Where do you think, any idea where she got her estrangement from her own being able to express her feelings?
I think her family was totally silent. Grandfather Stamba never spoke, as far as I know. I don't remember hearing him say anything. And I have a feeling that Grandmother Stamba was just hanging on for dear life. And she had a very hard life. She was a very active in the church woman. That was her life, in a way. So she was always doing good, but she wasn't having much fun. So it probably was a pretty barren. In fact, that picture of Mother and Uncle Guy standing there with, what did Mother have in her hand? A guitar.
Mm-hmm.
And Uncle Guy had a violin. I mean, those were equipments that were at the photographer's. They right. didn't have them.
Right. She didn't have any music.
No, no. Yeah. But she had a bright mind. She really had, and I have a feeling that Ada Woolley had a bright mind, Ada Woolley.
That would have fit even to be able to survive whatever. So you have no idea of the complexion of the relationship of your grandmother and grandfather on your mother's side, of however they met, of whatever it was initially in their early, none of that.
No, there's a tiny bit in those papers, but it's, I think it just says that they both came out from Iowa. I'm not sure they both were even in Iowa. I know that he would go to the Iowa picnics all the time when they lived in Long Beach. Big group of people that came to Long Beach, California from Iowa.
Hmm.
And they would have this annual Iowa picnic.
But you don't have any sense of your mother's family, because by the time you were cognizant after you're born and living your childhood years, you were a whole world away from them anyways, physically, by being on
right.
the other side of the world. So, and Mary never really talked about that.
That's right.
Because she was not want to.
But when you think that my grandmother Stamba, couldn't have been my grandfather because he didn't do that sort of thing. It must have been my grandmother Stamba that built that little cottage in back of their house, so that when her child and grandchildren and son-in-law would come home, they would have a place to live.
Yeah.
I mean, she was something.
Yeah.
She was a, had a lot of, strength. She had strong sense, and it must have been very hard on her when her daughter went off to Hawaii first and then went off to China. I mean, one more disappointment in her life. What was her life?
Yeah. Especially if the children that she did raise and spent a lot of her energy on then
yeah.
were so inaccessible.
Yeah.
Or, well, actually, both children, because Guy went up to Idaho.
Montana. Yeah. That wasn't so far away, because they were probably still in Spokane at that time.
Oh, when did they go to Long Beach?
My guess is after Grandma went to China, after 1916.
Hmm.
And I'm sure Betty Jean would know that, because she told me that Grandfather Stamba was interested, I told you this, was interested in the occult, and that he had that he loved Sidney a lot. Betty Jean's brother.
The crystal ball.
Yeah, gave Sidney the crystal ball in the black velvet bag that had a drawstring. So that's pretty interesting. So they must have continued to live up there.
Sure.
I don't know why they moved to Long Beach.
Huh. Well,
maybe they retired in Long Beach. You see, they'd had a store up there.
She had to have had enough money to have built a house in the back, so
yeah,
they weren't.
And there
destitute.
Was not Social Security those years, so they must have made money in their store.
Yeah. and plan for being able to provide for themselves and carry them through afterwards. So that may be him as well as her, whatever kind of practical nature that would be good at managing financial needs. And
I don't think he was very good at anything. He was just very good looking.
That's maybe why she married him.
Maybe so. Or, you know, they both wanted to come west. Hard to know.
And you'd said that you've not heard from Betty Jean for more than 2 years now, and you send letters and they don't go answered, and normally she would always respond.
Yeah, right.
But you also just said now that you thought that she would be the only other one you can think of who would.
Yeah, because I don't think, well, Sidney might be able to, but I'd lost touch with him.
And he might be. And maybe is still in New York?
No, he wouldn't be in New York. He'd be in L.A. He might have died. I know he was failing a lot.
Just from old age?
Yeah, I think he was. And he had gone blind, or pretty much blind. So Patty and Kirk saw him for a while in Los Angeles while they were there.
So Betty Jean would be the one if you could find out where she is now.
Mm. I have heard her new, I really should write her another letter. I can do that this week.
I don't know what other way there would be to find someone who's in another country.
Well, I had her address. I mean, she moved out of Mexico City to, I think, Puerto Vallarta or someplace where the air would be better, because she was wasn't emphysema, but it was like that. Her heart would just hit a very hard time. Her heart was not good in that awful air of Mexico City. And after they moved to Puerto Vallarta, wherever it was, and I do have that address, I did hear from her once, and she said she was better. She would come up to Los Angeles, which had terrible air, and she would improve just being in Los Angeles.
Wow. How old is she compared to you?
She's my age.
Wow.
Well, yeah, if nothing else, you could say that your youngest son is now more and more wanting to see what he can find out about his mother's mother's family. Not that she would, but maybe she'd be interested to share whatever she could think to write down. That would be the only other source.
Sure, and I'm sure she would have a lot of information. Yeah, and it might do her some good right now.
Wow. Well, another thing is for me to write a little letter for you to include with the letter you send. Maybe I'll try and write something in the next few days and send it to you.
Okay. That'd be nice.
You were mentioning, and we looked at another picture today, of Harold feeding the goat, and you thought he would probably be about an 1.5, and you thought that this was up in the mountains at Guanceling during the summertime, but you never went there.
I did, but I don't remember it.
Because it was too young for you.
We went back to China in 1925. And it was a year and a half. And my guess is we went back in the fall or late summer. So I would have been 2.5 going up to Guanceling. I wouldn't have remembered that.
Okay, yeah. But you knew what the photograph, because of photographs you saw later, you mean?
Yeah.
Do you have any other, I'm sure you do, but can you tell me anything else about fond memories or any kind of memories you have of things that were distinct, of happenings that you had when you were with Tien Da So?
I really can't. I remember she I think she made dresses for me. I'm not sure it was Tien Da So, or we had also had a sewing woman that did a lot of sewing. And it was up at the top of the stairs on the second floor, the sewing room was. It was a small room at the back of the house. And Tien Da So was just always there for me. I don't remember her. I don't think she put me to bed at night. I think she just was with me all day. when I was real little. And then she also stayed with me when I see my mother homeschooled all of us. And I don't know when that took place. But Tantasau would be there for me. I'm sure she picked up the upstairs and kept the rooms neat. And the mother would be off teaching. Not very far away, just the girls' school would be, or boys' and girls' school, very close. So I was not, it wasn't as if she would go far away, but Tantasau and all of our amas, you ask anybody who grew up in China, it's the ama that somehow was the nurturing, fun person to be with, fun second mother.
So it wasn't just that she would be present or hovering in the background, she would play with you?
Oh yeah, but I don't remember. She used to tell us stories in Chinese, and I say us because I think she perhaps was better educated than my two brothers, Ama.
Uh-huh.
And so she knew a lot of the Chinese. Well, they probably did too, because I don't think it was through education. They were orally passed down, Chinese folk tales, and she would tell us the stories in Chinese. And it was through our amas that we learned to speak Chinese, really.
Because they were always speaking.
Yeah.
You heard that through them.
Yeah.
They'd only speak to you in Chinese, or?
Oh yeah, they didn't know English. So, we, you know, we're lucky where we had these two languages very, very early.
And Harold was 5 years older than you?
Six.
So by the time you're 2, 3, and 4, he's already way out at the end of his childhood. And so you're not necessarily doing that much of the three of you together when you'd be playing during the day when you were 2, 3, 4, 5.
No, I really didn't know Harold very well. And he was, I think he was, always felt as if he was, because he was such a noisy little rambunctious kid, and my mother didn't know what to do with him, so he always felt strange. And Jim and I would play together somehow. We would gang up against him, and he and would always be trying to get Jim into trouble, and Jim would fall into it every time. I vaguely remember, I don't know who it was, or maybe both of them, probably not both of them, were being punished with no supper, and I took something up for them, somebody, probably Harold, to eat, snuck it up.
On the sly.
Yeah. But I just vaguely remember that. You know, probably thinking it was an unjust punishment.
Not feeling sorry for him, maybe, but just feeling like that wasn't fair, and so he should have something to eat.
Sure. Well, so I was feeling sorry for him.
But there was some kind of, to do something like that, you'd also on some level obviously feel, well, this is my brother.
And, oh, yeah. But still, Jim and I would gang up against him.
Because he was the oldest, he was the biggest, he was the...
Yeah, and the strangest. You know, the one that would be doing naughty things all the time. And then getting Jim in trouble.
And you and Jim would be like Patty and I. The two closest together in age,
especially of the
youngest two, would tend to
That's right, and the oldest always has a certain role by being the oldest. Yeah, like Steve.
Who I certainly, as I was a kid, he was distant, and I didn't know or appreciate him when I was really young. I could see when I went off to Thatcher in sophomore in high school, and he was up at Reed, and then he was in England, and he heard the Grateful Dead perform, and we had this thing going with this rock group and things, and there was for the first time a sense of appreciation and valuing of this person who up to that point was just in a different world from me.
Yeah.
So you would never have really a sense of Harold's, or maybe to some degree with Jim's, of Jim's ama, that the four of you would be there, not just the two of you, when you would be playing in the daytime,
yeah,
and your mom would be away.
Yeah.
If you were with Jim, at least, where you'd have more of a, what, 2 or 3 years apart?
3 years. We were all 3 years apart.
Mm-hmm.
But also there were the Hubbard family, this is Gladys's family, was in Batting Foo. And they had Gladys and Emma Rose. Gladys was the youngest, and Emma Rose, and then, I guess it was Gladys, youngest. Ward was next to Gladys, then Emma Rose, and then Wells was the oldest. So there were four kids there. And they were in the same compound that we were. And then they went off on furlough, and the Hunters came there. And there was Gene and Bobby Hunter. And Gene was my age. And Bobby was Jim's age. So there were kids, always some kids to play with in the compounds. I think the Mission Board sort of tried to do that, to work it out so that children would be in the same compounds together. And sometimes they would be shifted around, so like the Hubbards and the Hunters.
So there's more than one compound?
No, there would be more than... Oh, there were many compounds throughout China, different parts of... Because in the Batting Foo compound was our Mission Board, and then on the other side of Batting Foo City, which was a city, a walled city, was another compound, but I think that was Presbyterian. Might have been. I think it was Presbyterian. And it had the hospital in it, and they also had boys and girls school, too. But there was no hospital in our compound. And there were more houses in that compound, more foreign houses. The Wheelers lived in that compound. I knew Lois Wheeler because for a while the Wheelers were moved to Dejo. And the picture that I'm going to send to Gladys, the drawing of that, Wheelers lived in that compound for a while. So, and the Wheelers.